The men, on the other hand, did not shy away from violence towards their wives, due to the free pass the culture and law gave them in this regard. The women of America demanded rights to education, payment, and security.
Equal rights to set forth our own humanity, equal rights to get into graduate programs, to get into schools, to training programs. We're the bottom third of the employment in terms of pay. We represent nonetheless 34% of the workforce, yet we're the first to be laid off and the last to be hired. There aren't frivolous demands at all. We just want what men have had all these years.
This issue did not belong to past centuries. This is the United States of America of 1970. Although protests against domestic violence intensified during the second half of 1970, husbands abusing their wives and justifying their actions had roots in times as far as the first American immigrants who settled in those lands. When the first immigrants arrived in this region, they started to write laws for their newly founded America by forming a government. The first settlers of America took their law from the common law derived from the traditional rules of the British judicial system. Common law originated in England in the Middle Ages and was applied in British colonies across the continents. According to this law, a man had the right to punish his wife if needed. In 1982, an important event took place that marked the beginning of a review in the issue of domestic violence against women. Tracy Thurman, a housewife in the city of Torrington. First, in October 1982, Charles, Thurman's husband, had a fight with her and threw her out of the house. Tracy went to the police department, but the police did not handle her case, because there was no law to support her. A month later, it happened again. This time, Charles, Tracy's husband, broke the car window on her while she was sitting in the car. Tracy's body was covered with broken glass. This time, because the crime happened outside the house, the police got involved, and the court issued a restraining order against Charles for 2 years. However, during this period of 2 years, Charles repeatedly violated the court's order, and each time Tracy's complaint did not result in anything. Charles even threatened to kill her once, but the police did not do anything about it. A few months later, when Tracy was at home with her child, her husband Charles entered their residence. Tracy called the police. Charles stabbed Tracy's neck, throat, and chest with a knife. At this moment, a police officer arrived, but Charles, without fear, kicked Tracy in the head with another hard blow. Tracy was now lying on the ground in her own blood, but the police still did not react. Charles was about to attack Tracy, who was sleeping on the stretcher of the emergency team. But this time, the police stopped watching and finally arrested Charles after he had inflicted multiple stabbings and hittings to Tracy's head several times. Tracy Thurman spent 8 months in the hospital. Some of her body parts were temporarily and others permanently paralyzed. This time, instead of suing her husband, Tracy sued the police department for not supporting and defending her. Now, women's slogans had become more uniform and coherent. Women unite. Don't let racism divide us. Girls are powerful. The rise of women's protests against men's violence, along with the liberal slogans, marked yet another event. Feminist movements were gradually born, and protests against the inferior status of women and the violence they endured at home began in the American society. American states, one by one, began to repeal the laws that allowed men to punish women.
What does International Women's Year mean to you?
I'm afraid not very much, really. I'm a bit old to be worried, you know.
Do you ever think about women's liberation?
I don't, to tell you the honest truth, no.
I think possibly I'm like a lot of women and depend a lot on a husband, you know. On the male, on the male race, I guess.
The US government, maintaining that a man's home is his castle, had traditionally been reluctant to police the confines of the home. Moreover, many legal authorities insisted on blaming the victim and believed that the wife was partially responsible for her beating by provoking her husband and making him angry. American laws allowed a man to punish a woman under the pretext of reforming her. The courts only considered the complaint of a beaten woman if the woman was severely injured during the beating by her husband.
This is the police.
Okay, what I want is a battered woman.
You are a battered woman?
Yes.
Who assaulted you?
My ex. He's in the house and I'm scared.
Is he in the house?
Yes, and I'm scared.
It's a frying pan that he threw at me, and I'll show you the nightgown that I have that's got full of blood on.
David, you're under arrest for domestic violence.
However, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was approved by the United Nations General Assembly in Paris on December 10, 1948, said something else. Article 1 of the Declaration. All human beings are born free and are equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood.
Approved by an overwhelming majority, the Declaration of Human Rights as a standard of conduct for all. And let us, as members of the United Nations, conscious of our own shortcomings and imperfections, join our effort in good faith to live up to this high standard.
But women were still deprived of such a right in America. Violence against women was considered normal. This normality can be understood in a joke that was broadcast on the BBC radio in the same years. A woman asks another why she feels her husband doesn't love her anymore. She hears the answer. He hasn't beaten me in a week or two.
How many domestic violence calls do you get on most nights?
It might not be unusual to have six or eight. Is this the first time this has happened?
He got pissed off at me and said I was attacking him, and then he started hitting me.
Little by little, various organizations started to deal with the domestic violence against women under the title of non-governmental organizations. The law changed, but the culture of violence against women still carries on. The slogan of gender equality gradually made women own rights that might have been funny to think about in the United States a few decades ago. In addition to the right to vote and the right to employment and equal wages, they now had the right to wear clothes. They could decide for the life or death of the fetus inside their womb, or they could even have other kinds of freedom in sexual issues. But did helpless women really join feminism movements to achieve such freedoms? Apparently, everything has benefited women. But there is still a problem. Women were still beaten by men. Liberalism. It reinforced racism, classism, and other forms of oppression. Women were now oppressed again. But this time, this oppression was not only from their husbands. Every man who had the chance to communicate with that woman would provide the basis for this, with sexual harassment and physical violence. These are official statistics from within the United States. Every year, about 500,000 people in America are victims of sexual violence, including 12-year-old children. However, 90% of the people who were raped are adult women.
Stop domestic violence! Stop domestic violence! Stop domestic violence!
Well, he
Alexia is amazing. She was my only sister, my younger sister. We were 5 years apart, but super close. She's my best friend growing up and into adulthood. She's the life of any party. She lit up any room she walked into. She had goals and dreams and aspirations that were taken from her at the young age of 20 years old. In a domestic violence situation, as we're here today to honor. She had been away from him about 3 or 4 months when she had restraining orders and PPOs when he tracked her down and took her life. We organized a domestic violence walk in honor of my sister and those who have suffered through domestic violence, victims, or who are survivors who have gotten out. Anybody and everybody who has been in a domestic violence situation, we're out here today to honor them and hopefully spread awareness that, you know, you're not alone and there are resources out here.
She was amazing. Good kid.
She was all about her family, always with me or her sister or her niece, her dad.
Never got in trouble.
Yeah, never in trouble. She's just a good person. A great
very
heart.
Good girl. Would help anybody. She'd give a little shirt off her back.
The fact that it was pretty bad. It's sad. She's, you know, we miss her every day. You know, she was my baby niece, you know, so it's been pretty rough. Think about her constantly.
She's a beautiful person, so loving and friendly, and like she said, she's a life of the party. She's a great person. It's that, you know, it's sad that we have to do this because, you know, they took my niece from us. You know, it's sad that this is the thing we have to do, but we're trying to get justice for her, and we want people to be aware of it, what's going on.
2022. According to statistics, one out of every three women in the United States has experienced violence from her husband or partner. About 20,000 calls are made to the domestic violence help centers every day. And on the other end of the line are people who have been beaten or threatened with death by their spouses or partners. The phenomenon of violence against women in the United States may not be at the top of the world news like that of third world countries. But this does not mean that violence against women does not exist in the States. According to statistics from the National Office on Domestic Violence, one woman is battered every 9 seconds in the United States. Florida State Senator Janet Cruz's report is worth considering.
In Florida, there were 106,000 reported domestic violence offenses in 2020. And that was including more than 200 domestic violence murders.
This log home at Big Lake was one of Bree Moore's favorite places.
Her formal name is Brianna, but as she got older, she wanted to be called Bree.
Her parents say they can still feel her presence here.
She would get me up early in the morning and say, "Dad, come on, we've got to go. We've got to go ride." She made every minute out of her life special.
Police told the Moores their daughter's body was found at her boyfriend's home, where he lived with his parents. The Moores asked if there had been a home invasion.
They said no. They said Josh, her boyfriend, killed her.
Bree would be the last. Years later, what really was happening with Josh and in his history, this was really the inevitable.
But at the time, Bree seemed so devoted to her boyfriend, busy at her job as an aide in a dentist's office. But behind her smile, Bree's coworkers saw signs of trouble, signs they didn't reveal to the Moores until after her death.
They told me that she had come in several times with black eyes, and one time she came in and she hadn't just been hit, they said she had been beaten. And she couldn't function. And she vomited in the sink, and she left after about 15 minutes they sent her home.
There were other red flags.
Well, I'll read you a text message that we found on Bree's phone after we got her phone back 2.5 years after she was killed. Bree texts, "You better love me and stop hitting me, please," with an exclamation point. "Josh, of course I love you. And Ramrod hit you, not I." So Ramrod must have been, you know, when he got angry, I'm assuming.
Nadine M. Newfoyle, director of the Department of Violence Against Women at the U.S. Department of Justice, says Based on our findings in the United States, every day, 3 women in this country are murdered by their spouse or ex-partner. This statistic is very alarming for us. Nadine M. Newfoyle's story is not the story of primitive African tribes or so-called third world countries. This is the United States of America in the year 2022, the 21st century, the cradle of freedom and democracy.
Because Brandy's case reminded Guard of Anitra Coburn.
Carter kidnapped Anitra and eventually took her to her grandparents' trailer in Franklin County.
Coburn's boyfriend kidnapped her from her Pitt County home and murdered her after holding her hostage for a week.
Half a century has passed since the protests of American women in 1970. And now, domestic violence has the voice of Angelina Jolie, a Hollywood star who was also once a victim.
Most of all, I want to acknowledge the children who are terrified and suffering at this moment, and the many people for whom this legislation comes too late.
A bipartisan group of U.S. senators has introduced a proposal to reauthorize a 1990s law that expands protections for victims of domestic and sexual violence. This law was dissolved in 2019 due to the opposition of Republicans, which has led to the promotion and increase of violence and murder in American society. Angelina Jolie asks U.S. senators to approve this law and says, "I repeat, this is one of the most important votes you will cast in the Senate this year. When silence comes from a Congress too busy to renew the Violence Against Women Act after a decade, it reinforces that sense of worthlessness." It's clear that the indifference of the Congress and the American government has troubled the 47-year-old Oscar winner. This was the third time that Angelina asked the representatives of the U.S. Congress to revise the law to control domestic violence. This law was first sent to the Senate in 1990 by Joe Biden, who was then a senator, with the aim of reducing domestic and sexual violence. A later version was included in a bill signed by then-President Bill Clinton 4 years later. Congress has since reauthorized and extended the Violence Against Women Act 3 times.
Senator Joe Biden invited them to speak.
Battered women need to be taken seriously. Proper police response can prevent what happened to me from happening to someone else. Thank you.
Thank you.
The story of domestic violence in the United States and the law to deal with it is a paraphrase of the saying, "The law often shows its teeth, but does not bite." The United States. United States has moved away from the slogan of creating equal conditions and ideal and happy life for women. In a way, this shows America cannot be a good model for other societies. Feminist slogans try to make women equal to men in all matters. For example, the society should witness that women are beaten less. But why did feminism and women's movements target the family to achieve this goal? It was already known that a woman without a family would be disarmed. And that's how it happened. In practice, women still did not get their real rights. Until yesterday, they were under male violence at home. But today, they are under the domination of employers and cheap forces. They are now also responsible for financing themselves, a task that, at least in the distant years, was the responsibility of men. A century has passed from the American women's efforts to escape domestic violence and achieve equality. Yet domestic violence still takes 3 victims every day. Families are broken. Women are employed in menial jobs. And the salary and benefit system still consider women as second-hand labor. Kindergartens have expanded, but next to girls' high schools, right beside unmarried mothers. Joni Ernst, a Republican senator, is also a victim of sexual and domestic violence. Thank you.
Munley.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. A humanitarian organization whose responsibility was allegedly to distribute aid and food became another tool of war in Gaza. This is how many Palestinians describe the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, or GHF. In May of this year, after the Israeli regime stopped all other aid distribution, it allowed the U.S.-backed GHF to be the only entity inside of Gaza providing aid. Distribution points turned into death traps, and now after 6 months of operations, the foundation is suspending its work in Gaza. Many Palestinians say the organization must be held responsible for their role in weaponizing aid and its overall role in the U.S.-Israeli genocide. Here's a report.
The Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, created and controlled by the United States and Israel, has announced the end of its emergency mission in Gaza. But for Palestinians, this mission was never about salvation. It was a blueprint for mass killing. According to the Gaza government media office, the foundation provided a false humanitarian cover, transforming its aid distribution centers into death traps and sites of mass killing.
And the idea is that they're a charitable organization. They're not for profit. But in this case, they're for killing. I'd just like to point out that there are 2,600 dead and injured people who were trying to access the Gaza so-called Humanitarian Foundation's facilities.
The foundation's centers, often run by former U.S. military personnel, became theaters of execution. Witnesses describe Israeli forces opening sniper fire and artillery on hungry civilians funneled into those open areas. The locations transformed to deliberate death traps employed by Israel as tools of genocide. Despite the international condemnation, including UN officials who called the system unsafe and humiliating, the U.S. found more excuses.
Certainly nothing will be perfect. I've said this before, that it can't be perfect because it is an unnatural, obscene environment. To demand perfection or a new normal of this environment is unacceptable. Nothing will be enough.
With its withdrawal, Hamas has demanded immediate international legal action to hold to account the foundation and its American and Israeli backers.
We call upon all international human rights organizations to ensure GHF does not escape accountability after causing the death and injury of thousands of Gaza people and covering up the starvation policy practiced by the Israeli regime.
The world watched as famine was engineered, humanitarian gestures became death traps, and the people were systematically starved to death or executed. This was not a failure of aid, but a calculated strategy of genocide, facilitated by powerful nations. The empty plates and mass graves of Gaza are testament to this betrayal. The world will remember that it allowed and watched a genocide and then simply moved on.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Mazen Qom Saeed, university professor, historian, and author out of Bethlehem. And Mick Napier, co-founder of Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Glasgow. Well, welcome both of you to the program. I'm going to start it off in Bethlehem. I mean, your thoughts overall about this Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. We know that the United Nations, prior to GHF, was operating 400 aid sites in Gaza, and then the Israeli regime shut them down, and it was just the GHF that was on the ground with four hubs, with, you know, in all of that that area. So do you think that to begin with it was a formula that was set up to fail and to cause as much misery as possible, or how do you see it?
Well, I see what Israel and the U.S. are doing is basically experimenting with different techniques of torturing the people of Gaza. The acronym GHF for me stands for Genocide Hellish Foundation, as your reporters showed, basically, that thousands of people were killed in these death traps. But there are other mechanisms that Israel is using, and now, you know, the reason they are removing this foundation and creating other mechanisms in the form of what's called green areas and red areas separated by the yellow line is another method of ethnic cleansing and genocide of the people of Gaza. So they experiment in different methodologies of destroying the people of Gaza, destroying the livelihood of Gaza. This is what they have been doing not even since October 2023, but since May 1948, when they experimented with how to remove Palestinian villages and towns, in some cases poisoning water wells, in other cases shelling them to oblivion, in other cases scaring them or raping women and committing massacres. So they tried different techniques, but the end result that they aim for is a Palestine without Palestinians and to rename it the Jewish State of Israel. That's the original plan and has not changed.
What about that, Mick, that basically experimenting and seeing different ways of being able to torture the Palestinians, according to our guests in Bethlehem? I mean, if we look at the Zionist entity and what it has done, along with the U.S. government, would you say that the setup of this GHF not only should be, of course, blamed on the Zionists and the Americans, but the whole Western hegemonic front that allowed this entity to commit genocide and then allowed the same entity to decide who can actually distribute aid to the people that they are targeting and killing every day?
You set us up in this program for a very difficult task, and it's to find a language to describe the horror, the depravity and the barbarism of what's being visited upon the people of Palestine. And as our other guest points out, this goes back a very, very long way. But let's try. I think that in science and in politics and in any other area of life, if you have a simple theory that explains everything, then we should use that theory. And Israel wants to kill Palestinians. Israel, I mean, Ariel Sharon was quoted by another cabinet minister as saying in a cabinet meeting that the only good Arab was a dead Arab. And that's what he said, and that's what he meant. And that was his whole history. His whole record was based on that idea. And the whole Zionist project is based on that. They would much prefer, like a Pied Piper, for the Palestinians to follow a piper and leave Palestine. But in reality, they know they have to use overwhelming violence and full-spectrum criminality in order to achieve their goal. Their goal is, as they say to the world, to remove Palestinians from Gaza. And Donald Trump joins in to turn it into a real estate deal. But, you know, it's absolutely bestial. There is experimentation because the Zionists are strategic. The present crop of mass killers are different from earlier crops. I mean, we saw, for example, in the Great March of Return a few years ago, thousands of Palestinians maimed, industrial numbers injured and crippled, and hundreds, thousands killed over the course of that experiment by the Palestinians in peaceful demonstration, and an experiment by the Zionists in industrial scale killing in the full view of the world. And I think we have to go back to that to say, when the Israelis found out that they could do that, that they could openly in their press boast about snipers killing and maiming Palestinians, when one of them could boast in the media that he, in one shift, killed, or not killed, shattered 43 Palestinian knees with his sniper rifle. When they saw that they could get away with that, then they decided to escalate.
Okay.
Because, and that's what we're seeing. We're seeing diabolical killing, full spectrum killing. And the key thing is, as you've alluded to, the Western chancelleries have not been critical. They've been silent. They have continued to send weapons. But if you think that one of the elements of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation was actually, and I think if you wrote this into a novel, nobody would believe it, was a motorcycle gang, an anti-Islamic motorcycle gang with a history of provoking Muslims. But this bandit gang, this gang was hired by the Americans to man, to staff the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation.
Stay with me, Mick. Let me get Mazen back in on this. I mean, it's so dystopian, of course, when we think about everything that has taken place and continues to take place in Gaza. I mean, one of them is this, Mazen, your perspective, because the person that was hired to originally run this GHF was actually a former American sniper, an American sniper turned aid worker, and even he couldn't handle it more than 2 weeks. He said that it lacked basic humanitarian principles of neutrality. It is absolutely so mind-boggling when we just think about what is happening and continues to happen. I mean, your thoughts on this, Mazen?
Well, indeed, one of the people who worked for GHF eventually explained that this was the policies that were practiced. There was not about humanitarian aid. There was about control and starvation and killing, while projecting that the U.S. and Israel care about the Palestinians, civilians in Gaza, because they were afraid of sanctions and afraid of the growing boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. So, you know, this, as I said earlier, is a form of psychological warfare and propaganda, what the Israelis call Hasbara, what the Americans call Hollywood productions of actions to produce a certain result that's desired in the mainstream media of Western countries. Of course, the people of Gaza don't buy it. People around the world didn't buy it, and there was a lot of talk about it. And I think eventually that's why they closed it and end up now trying new tools or new techniques.
Right, right. Well, Mick, since the GHF started its distribution, so-called distribution, in May of this year, 3,000 more Palestinians were killed at those so-called distribution centers. It is outrageous. It is unbelievable. I don't even know the words that we can use for this, to even think that at a place that's supposed to be safe and distributing aid, that thousands and thousands of people were killed and thousands of others just simply humiliated and treated as if they were not human. Your thoughts about, first of all, how this was allowed, and two, that the world allowed it to happen. I mean, this is the reality. We know that there have been protests here and there and around the world, but at the bottom of the line, Palestinians are still starving to death as we speak.
I think genocides supervised by the Americans have been going on for a very, very long time. 3 million killed in Vietnam. And as a young man, I learned that they were openly scattering tiny little plastic, brightly colored little bombs across the land surface of Vietnam, specifically to be picked up by children, and specifically to blow off parts of their limbs.
Right.
Not to kill them, but to overload the society, the health service, the social networks. And when I heard about this barbarism, which was not denied by anyone, was openly, not openly in the mass media on page one, but you could find it in scholarly journals. When I realized this was going on, I could never unlearn that. And you know, these genocides have been happening for a very, very long time. What's unique about the Gaza genocide, the Palestinian genocide, is that it does take place in the full glare of social media. That although Israel has killed, I'm sorry, I can't remember the number, is it 250 journalists during the last 2 years? They've killed so many journalists, but still other heroic figures are working as journalists in Palestine and Gaza today and telling that story. So it cannot be covered up. I mean, not one person in 100 knows about the Guatemala genocide, where America overthrew a democratically elected government, installed a monstrous regime which used germ warfare against their own native population. It was a genocide, and it's hardly known today. But people cannot ignore what's happening in Gaza, and they know it and they see it. And at the terrible cost that Gaza people have paid, Palestinians are paying, they have changed the consciousness of a huge chunk of the world to a degree that I find unprecedented, that this has burned deeply into people's awareness. And we see this in primetime social media. But our own governments are complicit, and they are not complicit in the sense that they're helping it. My own government is an active participant in it. So that the Royal Air Force flew over Gaza 500 times and gave intelligence to the killers on the ground. Mm-hmm. And then they admitted this in Parliament. So it's not that this is hidden. It's not that you can find out if you make an effort, which is the case with other genocides. It's that you cannot ignore it. And the full bestiality and barbarism of what's going on is really causing ripples around the world. In Britain, for example, the government has to arrest thousands of people who are protesting in support of the people of Palestine. Thousands of, literally thousands are being arrested. I myself face 14 years imprisonment for solidarity activity. It's nothing, but it's nothing compared to what the Palestinians suffer. But our governments are forced into this repression. My daughter lives in Berlin. The police there are brutal. Anybody who appears in the street there with a keffiyeh or anything that signifies Palestine runs a serious risk. So it's public, it's well known, the governments know it, and they're using repression to try to sustain their support for the genocide.
Right. Well, Mazen, I mean, with the GHF, when Monday it announced that it's going to be suspending its operations, it also said that it's basically ready to expand its humanitarian actions dealing with the new creation of the Civil Military Coordination Center, a base now that has been set up in the occupied territories, seen as a transition with the U.S. military allegedly meant to oversee aid distribution and the so-called rebuilding of Gaza, part of that Trump plan. Your thoughts about this? I mean, we have seen, as I said, thousands of people were killed on their watch, and now they're saying we're suspending this, but we're waiting for basically bigger and better things to be able to help, so-called help the Palestinians in Gaza even more.
Well, what we are seeing is history repeats itself. As I said, once as a farce, once as tragedy, but history is repeating itself. You know, in 1920, the League of Nations gave a mandate to Palestine, to the British Empire, and now the United Nations has given a mandate to the American Empire for Palestine, for the West Bank, for the Gaza Strip, and the Gaza GHF basically was a test model for this mandate. They are refining it to implement basically an international US-led oversight of the local people against the wishes of the local people. And of course, they don't want the local people to have any agency, and they want the local people to just do whatever they ask them to do, including disappear and die without any resistance. This is the plan, and this is the Trump plan, supported by Netanyahu, of course, and his government, this regime here, who could not win in Gaza, could not advance by military force. It could only, win the destruction of the people of Gaza and the landscape of Gaza, but could not win against the resistance. They want now Trump and the U.S. administration to achieve what they failed militarily to achieve it via what they will project as a political solution. They even call it a peace plan. I don't know where the peace comes from. Israel kills on average 2 children every day during the so-called ceasefire for almost a month now. So what you see on your screen is basically what needs to be done. Israel and the U.S. should be taken to international courts for violations of basic human rights, for war crimes, crimes against humanity. They should be subjected to sanctions, boycotts, divestments. That's the way we must go.
All right. Well, what about that, Mick? You heard what Madison said. Do you think that the responsible parties will be held responsible, will be held accountable? Because when we're looking at, of course, the Israeli entity and the Americans with the GHF in this, we also see the privatization and weaponization of aid in general. At the end of the day, are any of these entities going to be held responsible, in your perspective?
You know, I like to think I can, in a shadowy way, see what the options are going forward. But on this one, I honestly don't know. The ICC in the past tried war criminals, but they were all black, apart from the Serbians, because any war criminals operating on behalf of the NATO powers were completely immune. Nobody dreamt of trying Kissinger, for example. So, but the case that the ICJ and the ICC has accepted against Israel and against Netanyahu, they accepted them because if they hadn't, the whole structure would have collapsed. It would have not just been very partisan and very unfair and only trying some war criminals and exempting others, which has always been the case, but it would have been seen around the world that genociders had nothing to fear from the ICJ or the ICC. So they had to initiate a process, and the South African government bravely stepped up there to the plate, and I think 14 other governments are supporting them. But where is the power? Where is the police that will enforce a judgment from the ICJ and the ICC? The only country in the world, as far as I know, found guilty by the ICJ for terrorism was the USA. They were actually found guilty when Nicaragua brought a case against them. But America just ignored it and continued to carry out remorseless massacres across the whole of Central America. So they didn't give a fig for that decision. So looking forward, your question is a fundamental question, but I cannot answer it. Nothing leads me to believe that these structures will actually enforce sanctions against the genociders, because they've never done so in the past. What they can do is, if they make a ruling, they can stimulate civil society to take action. We saw the docker strikes and the riots and demonstrations in Italy recently in support of the Palestinian people and against their regime, which is very pro-Israel. We see in some places in America, we see dock workers for many years have refused to unload any Israeli ships. So we see the possibility of defeating them, but that defeat will not come from these official structures. It will not come from our governments who are complicit, who are making money, who completely agree with the genocide. Why would America not support Israeli genocide? America's born from genocide. Smallpox blankets, extermination of the native people. It's natural for the elites there to have sympathy with their latter-day acolytes. So I don't think any hope can come from there. But hope can come when people begin to speak Italian in the sense of the recent riots and strikes. And that can defeat Israel and will defeat Israel.
All right. And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me on this spotlight. Mazen Qomsai, University Professor, historian and author out of Bethlehem. Mick Napier, co-founder of Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Glasgow. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en.